From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More states start reopening this week. As President Trump says, some people may be affected badly. There may even be some deaths. But, quote, we have to get our country open.
There have already been more than 71,000 deaths in the U.S. and more than 1.2 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus. Making matters worse, there's another government whistleblower this week alleging that the Trump administration has been prioritizing political expediency over science and safety. Joining us now is Washington Post national political reporter Robert Costa. Robert, we'll get to the whistleblower in a moment, but we also have news today that the coronavirus task force, which includes Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx, will continue indefinitely after the administration said yesterday it would be winding down soon. But there are so many threads to follow here. What are you focused on?
So the president has said he's going to wind down the task force, but still keep it going. And based on my reporting, the real question, the debate inside of the White House is how influential will this task force actually be? Because the president and many of his top officials are full speed ahead trying to reopen the economy. And despite health data being very troubling in many states and many hotspots, that theme of reopening is now driving policy, the whole agenda inside of the White House. And the task force, it may continue, but you haven't seen Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx have the kind of presence they have had in recent weeks.
Well, and there are questions, and it gets us to this whistleblower about whether the Trump administration is sidelining people who say things that they don't want to hear. Tell us more about Rick Bright, the latest whistleblower, and what he's alleging in this whistleblower complaint.
He is going to be the biggest story next week because Dr. Fauci will testify before the Republican-controlled Senate, but it's Dr. Bright, the whistleblower, who left the government because of his concerns that the president and his team were pushing hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malaria drug that's had issues about heart problems. He has been troubled not only by that, but by the administration's efforts on PPE. He detailed in his documents ahead of his testimony that he's going to talk about Peter Navarro inside of the White House raising red flags about a pandemic, yet the White House being slow to respond. So he's a real opportunity for Congress to have some oversight and to flex its muscle in looking into these issues.
Bright also claims that his boss, Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary for Preparedness and Response, Robert Kadlec, pressured him to buy drug treatments and medical supplies from politically connected companies. We now know that Kadlec didn't disclose at least one conflict of interest on vaccines. What more can you tell us about that?
And you also see a new whistleblower about Jared Kushner, the president's senior advisor and son-in-law, and his efforts to, in essence, control a lot of the supply chain response at the White House. And you're seeing so many officials, whether it's on background or on record, raise concerns about how Kushner and the White House took command of this operation and effectively sidelining many bureaucrats who felt like they should be making the decisions. All this could come out into the open next week when Dr. Bright goes under oath.
And what has been the response from the administration?
A defiance at every turn, shrugging off the idea that they did anything wrong. This is a president and a White House who are saying that everything's going well. Jared Kushner has talked about the economy, quote, being rocking by summer. So it's sunniness and optimism from the White House, but the testimony could paint a different picture, and so does the health data across the nation.
Robert, we just did a segment yesterday about the fact that this pandemic has now claimed more American lives than the Vietnam War did. And historian Julian Zelizer said he sees parallels between President Lyndon Johnson saying everything was great in 1968, when clearly the facts said otherwise, and what's happening today with President Trump continuing to say this is going to be over soon and even sidelining people who say otherwise. Your thoughts?
You think back to those images of Lyndon Johnson in 1968 struggling amid the Vietnam War, deciding ultimately not to run for re-election. It's a contrast to what we see in the Trump White House, a belief on the president's side, whether it's in the David Muir interview or the Fox News interview at the Lincoln Memorial, that he can rejigger this economy, that he can win re-election. And so much of the talk among my sources in the Republican Party is about that re-election campaign, about the economy. And they believe that the health data may be bad, but it's not as bad as they would have thought. And so they're trying to just get everything moving in the direction of reopening. But so many states still struggling with tests and other issues.
Just briefly, do Republican leaders that you talk to outside of the White House believe the White House is doing a good job right now?
Those are saying so publicly, yet yes, they think that they're doing a pretty good job. But privately, let me tell you, a lot of concern among those running for U.S. Senate, for U.S. House in the Republican Party. Could a surge in cases and deaths this summer and fall in an economy that doesn't jump back, could that really cost the Republicans the Senate majority and the White House? Those are lingering and real concerns among my Republican sources.
That is Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert, thanks as always.
Thank you.
In Georgia, a new graphic video of the shooting of an unarmed black man has surfaced. 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery was shot and killed in Brunswick, Georgia in February. Former officer Gregory McMichael, who is white, told police his son Travis shot Arbery after they both tried to question him about break-ins in the neighborhood. There were no charges. But the new video, taken through the front window of another vehicle, shows Ahmaud Arbery jogging down a street as the McMichaels truck pulls over. Then we see Arbery fighting off the son who shoots him. It is hard to listen to. Now the father, Gregory McMichael, who was also a former investigator for the local prosecutor's office, and his son Travis could face charges. The case is going to a grand jury. Emily Jones, a reporter with Georgia Public Broadcasting based in Savannah, is here. Emily, we don't know who filmed that cell phone video. They pull over behind the McMichael truck, or why that video was posted on a local radio station. But what more do we know about what happened that day?
We don't know a lot, and that's part of why a lot of people have been really angry and frustrated about this case for a long time, because beyond the initial police report, you know, the suspects have not been arrested, they haven't been charged, and there hasn't been much further investigation. Although now the Georgia Bureau of Investigation has said that they've been requested to investigate it, so there will be an investigation now, in addition to the case going before the grand jury. And as far as the video is concerned, the Glynn County Police Department has actually also requested an investigation into how the video got released to the public, because it's not entirely clear how it was leaked.
Well, and again, whose it is, so we'll keep an eye on that. But meantime, this has gone before other prosecutors. One said that the case may not warrant charges because there was no probable cause. You know, why were there no charges, or at least a deeper investigation, more witnesses back in February? What happened?
A piece of it, for sure, and also a piece of why it's May and we're just seeing this movement on a shooting from February is that the district attorney who plans to take this case before a grand jury is actually the third district attorney involved in this case. The two men, as you mentioned, are a father and a son. And the father, Gregory McMichael, was an investigator in the Brunswick District Attorney's office for more than 20 years. And prior to that, he was a county police officer. So the Brunswick District Attorney, who normally would be in charge of a case like this, removed herself from the case, citing that conflict of interest. And then the state assigned the case to a neighboring district attorney. But Arbery's family actually requested that that second district attorney also remove himself from the case because he has a son who works in the Brunswick District Attorney's office again. So that's part of the delay. But the same reasons that those district attorneys have had to remove themselves from the case are also why a lot of folks in the community are raising some questions, because the ties that these men have to local law enforcement, and that, you know, that raises a lot of suspicions for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, and we should say that prosecutor that I mentioned might have been referring to the fact that guns are legal. The McMichaels had the right to pursue a burglary suspect, which they said they told police they thought Arbery was, a right to use force to protect themselves. But now this video seems to show that it was Arbery who was being pursued by them, and the family lawyer is saying it seems clear that it looks like he was being hunted down on that video. Given that that's what people are saying, what is the feeling in the community?
you know, a lot of people are very quickly pointing to the racial dynamics in this case. But I do want to say also that the people who are upset about this, it's not only Brunswick's Black community and it's not only Georgia's Black community. It's the outrage and the outcry really does seem to kind of cut across a lot of society and a lot of divides. A lot of people are really upset about this.
And we should say, too, it intersects with COVID-19 in that some of the protesters had been leery of street protests because of the stay-at-home orders. But last night they chose to go out. And it might hold it up in the court system because of how restrictions are impacting courts in your area. So we'll continue to follow this. Emily Jones with Georgia Public Broadcasting in Savannah. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Something caught our ear at the beginning of the pandemic. We heard that the Metropolitan Opera laid off all of its unionized workers, invoking a contract clause called force majeure, or a superior force in French. And now we're hearing the legal world is expecting a wave of litigation, businesses citing the government closures because of the pandemic, saying that's a force majeure, an act of God. Nancy Kim is a professor of Internet Studies and Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. Professor Kim, how big is this? And do these have to be clauses, by the way, in a contract? Or can someone just say, oops, I can't fulfill my obligation because of force majeure?
Well, these are a very big deal, and we're going to see a lot more cases involving force majeure clauses. These are clauses in contracts which do exactly what you say, but it will depend on how they're drafted. So if I said to you, the parties will be excused from performance for events not within their reasonable control, including fire, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Mm-hmm. In that case, if the event that occurs is not like the ones that are listed out there, then you're out of luck. But if you said including but not limited to, then you might be in luck. It's,
oh, wow.
I mean, these little wording changes in wording make a big difference. But even if a contract doesn't have a force majeure clause, a party to a contract may try to get out of it based on another contract defense known as impracticability or maybe frustration of purpose, where when something happens that's unexpected, that the parties hadn't anticipated, they're not able to perform because of this.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Can you just say, there's a pandemic, and so, sorry, we can't do this? Or does it have to be more specific? I can't fulfill my obligation because the government has said that my workers can't come back. And so it's the government order, really, that is the leverage there as opposed to the pandemic.
In most cases, it will be the governmental order because the pandemic doesn't sort of prevent you, unless you're sick, your business isn't actually going to be prevented from doing what they're supposed to do. It's just the concern you have for your employees or for yourself that might cause you to take precautions. And so the governmental orders have been helpful in a sense in that they've provided companies with something to justify their inability to perform. And so the concern is that when these restrictions start to be lifted, governors should be very careful in how they word the lifting of restrictions. There should be some, you know, cautionary languages. Businesses that are not able to provide the necessary safety equipment must not open, something to that effect. Because otherwise, businesses might be put in a position of having to fulfill their contractual obligations when they're really not ready in terms of having the necessary equipment to be able to do so.
And if the government says that they can open, they lose that ability to say to a business that they were going to interact with, I can't interact with you, I can't fulfill my contractual obligation, whatever it is, you know, buy something from a vendor. I can't do that because the government has ordered me to shut down. They lose that ability if the government tells them to open.
Right, because under most force majeure clauses, the performance has to actually be prevented. And again, the pandemic isn't preventing unless you're actually ill, somebody from performing, whereas a law or a governmental order, which tells you that you can't open your business, is preventing you from being able to perform.
Well, that's why in March, after Governor Cuomo in New York banned large gatherings, the general manager of the Met invoked force majeure in their contract with unionized employees, laying off all of them. So these clauses are not just between businesses. They can cover workers who are unionized or contract workers. What other examples can you see of when these might be used?
Well, they're going to be used in a lot of different situations, especially when you have businesses and suppliers, and you kind of have this domino effect if one party is not able to purchase what they had originally ordered. So there aren't any clear good guys or bad guys in this scenario. And it's going to be a matter of assessing who is in the best position to bear this loss that's created. And another thing I think that courts will be looking at is whether or not a business, you know, made an effort to try to meet its contractual obligations without looking to the force majeure as an easy out, because it's not going to be an easy out. You know, it's, I mean, let's be clear about one thing. It's not a situation where the clause should be used, and I think it will not be successfully used in situations where somebody's just trying to get out of a losing contract.
That's Nancy Kim, professor of Internet Studies and Law at California Western School of Law. Professor Kim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, we want to look now at something that's happening in emergency rooms. COVID-19 patients showing up without any obvious respiratory distress, even though they turn out to be suffering from pneumonia so advanced that the only treatment is a ventilator. Some doctors are now recommending a simple device called a pulse oximeter. You know, you put your finger in a little plastic cuff and it tells you your oxygen level. And if you see it's falling, you can seek treatment maybe before you get to more serious illness. But others, including the chief medical officer of the American Lung Association, are saying not so fast. So what should we do? Let's bring back Dr. Len Horowitz, a pulmonologist at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. He's seen some of these sick patients. And Dr. Horowitz, it was ER doctor Richard Levitin who wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times extolling these devices. People bought so many, it's hard to find one. So first, what is a pulse oximeter? What does it do?
The oximeter is a device that's very simple. You insert your finger into the device. If you have no nail polish on, your room temperature, the device will read how much your blood is saturated with oxygen. The normal level of oxygenation is between 90 and 99%. As you get below 90% saturation, 88 or below can be a warning that there is serious hypoxemia, meaning low oxygen tension. Those patients may not require a ventilator, but they certainly require supplemental oxygen.
Well, and when it comes to COVID-19, we understand that these patients, you know, again, they're not gasping for air, so they don't know that this is happening. It's called a silent hypoxia, I understand.
The first phase of hypoxemia is so-called silent because there's not a lot of inflammation yet inside the lungs, and the lungs are relatively compliant and elastic the way they normally are. The problem with COVID arises because COVID seems to attack the endothelial, the inner lining of arterioles, tiny little arterioles that help oxygenate or expel carbon dioxide. Now, you have to remember that people need oxygen for their tissues to work, every cell in the body. And if you're not moving, you don't have a lot of oxygen requirement. You can tolerate an oxygen saturation of 85% as long as you're just sitting and not moving. So the first stage is in a patient who's just sitting there having endothelial damage, but not much inflammation yet in the lung. In the second stage, which can follow in hours, the lung becomes very involved in an inflammatory process where liquids, cytokines, inflammatory mediators build up in the lungs, white blood cells come to fight the battle, and the lungs get stiffer, heavier, less elastic, and those patients, along with low oxygen, need to be placed on a ventilator because their work of breathing and their oxygen saturation are so bad that they need a ventilator.
Well, we mentioned Richard Levitin. He was seeing patients come in with a, you said, you know, it should be in the 90s, coming in with a 50% oxygen rate. But these people have been sick. They've had an upset stomach, a headache. When you first start having those symptoms, you know, let's say they were sick for a week. If they had taken their oxygen level and not waited till they became short of breath, would they possibly have a better outcome?
It's possible. It's clear that checking oxygen saturation is not valuable. If you feel fine, you're going about usually activities. But most patients who have this silent hypoxemia have a little bit more than just abdominal pain or a headache. They've been sick. And certainly COVID patients that have come down with a fever, chills, sinusitis, and cough, or any kind of shortness of breath, should check their oxygen saturation. There's a great utility in that. For the normal person, it's like taking your temperature every 15 minutes. What's it really going to tell you? Most people don't take their temperature unless they feel like they have a fever.
Is there a risk? I mean, can you misinterpret the readings?
No. The only way you could misinterpret the readings would be if you had nail polish on or your hands were extremely cold, and then you just decide to stick your finger in the oximeter. So I think it's important to have a reason. The reason we wash our hands, for instance, is not to touch our face and not to contaminate other people. The reason you check a pulse oximeter is you have a question about whether your oxygen saturation is okay or not, based upon a suspicion of illness.
The American Lung Association says unless you have a chronic lung or heart condition that affects your oxygen saturation on a regular basis, most people don't need one. Their point was they're concerned that, as you've been saying, doctor, you could get obsessive about it and ignore other things that a doctor might pick up if you actually went to a doctor's checkup. Do you agree?
Yes, I do. Let's say your symptoms aren't particularly pulmonary at first. It might be nausea, diarrhea, headache, sometimes neurological symptoms. Well, that may make you think that your oxygen's fine. You don't need to check it because you're preoccupied with these other symptoms, which you might not actually associate with COVID. And so there's a utility once you have an index of suspicion. But if there's no index of suspicion, there's no utility.
That's pulmonologist Len Horovitz, who practices at Lenox Hill Hospital in Manhattan and has been helping us understand some of the complexities of COVID-19. Dr. Horovitz, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin.
Iowa's Governor Kim Reynolds is in Washington today meeting with President Trump. COVID-19 cases keep climbing in her state, even as Iowa forges ahead with its reopening. Sioux City has the most new cases per capita over the past 2 weeks of any metro area in the country. And most of the hardest hit counties with per capita case levels similar to New York are home to meatpacking plants. Reporter Grant Gerlach from Iowa Public Radio is in Des Moines. Grant, Iowa keeps trending up with its cases. Is there any sense the state has hit or is near a peak?
Well, yeah, we're still seeing hundreds of new cases each day. The number of deaths per day has been increasing. Even some of the counties that were allowed to reopen, we're now seeing the pace of new cases increase. So Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has been talking about the number of cases leveling off, reaching a peak, starting to get beyond a peak. And part of that's because we're doing more testing, but talking to people who study infectious disease here, they're saying when you look at the number of cases, the number of deaths, that's not the sign of getting past a peak.
Now, the state did start its partial reopening last Friday. Malls and restaurants can reopen, churches too. What have you seen? Are places opening and are people going to them?
Yeah, you see pictures of restaurants where every other booth or table has been taped off so that people have to keep a distance. And many restaurants, retail stores have reopened. Some have stayed closed because they don't feel like they have enough room for social distancing, so they'll keep doing carryout or deliveries. I would say in most places, a lot of places have reopened, but people have not exactly been rushing back into going out to eat or going shopping. And similar with churches, you know, churches can return to worship services, and a few did hold services, especially with small congregations. But after the governor made her announcement that they could resume worship, the leaders of several denominations released a joint statement saying they weren't going to do it until the state has more testing and more tracing across the state. They didn't feel like it was safe to reopen yet.
Okay, so they didn't feel like it was safe to reopen, but when it comes to the meatpacking plants, it sounds like they don't have much of a choice now because the president has ordered meatpacking plants across the country to stay open. Governor Reynolds has said she'll make sure that happens. What's going on there, and is there pushback about that?
Yeah, so the latest is a plant, Tyson Foods plant in Waterloo, Iowa, where more than 400 workers tested positive. It's set to reopen this week on Thursday. And most of the other plants where we've seen hundreds of cases have shut down for a period of time and they're back open. There's a Tyson plant in Perry, Iowa that shut down for a day for cleaning. They have more than 700 confirmed cases there, and that's more than half of the workers at the plant. So obviously we've seen this trend across the state where meatpacking plants have been hotspots for rural communities and urban communities. There are workers and groups that advocate for workers that have been speaking out about that, about the lack of protection inside the plants, which the companies say they're addressing, but it's still work that takes place, you know, shoulder to shoulder, even if there are some plastic dividers. And what workers say is they would have to slow the processing line if workers are going to be allowed to spread out. But that's something that meat companies have resisted. And there's a group here, the League of United Latin American Citizens, LULAC. They've called for a meatless May to boycott the conditions at the packing plants.
That is Grant Gerlach, a reporter with Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Grant, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Travis Holcomb is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us once again. Hi, Travis. How's it going?
Hey, Jeremy.
And how are you holding up in the pandemic, first of all?
You know what? I'm doing as well as anyone can do, I guess. You know, like it's obviously been a major disruptive force in life, but I think that goes for everybody.
Right. I think as long as you have your health and you have a job, that's at least two good marks in this moment. So you brought us some new music, which, believe it or not, is still coming out despite these strange times. Is there a theme that you had in mind with all these picks?
You know what? The first pick that we're going to talk about sort of fits the quarantine mood, I think. And then maybe we can like figure out how to make the other ones work into the quarantine vibe.
Okay. All right. We'll come up with the theme as we go along. The first one is Fiona Apple. This is called Cosmonauts.
When I met you, I was fine with my nothing. I grew with you and now I've changed. What I've become is something I can't be without your loving. Be good to me. It isn't a game. Now let me see, it's you and me, forgive, good God. How do you suppose that we'll survive? Come on, that's right, left, right. Make lighter all the heavier, cause you and I will be like a couple of cosmonauts. Except with way more gravity than when we started off. Whoa, you and I will be like a couple of cosmonauts. Except with way more gravity than when we started off.
Travis, this is from Fiona Apple's new album, which is getting so much praise right now.
It is a phenomenal album. It's the best album of maybe the last 2 or 3 years. And wow, it arrived without any advanced singles and not that much fanfare. I mean, you know, obviously people know Fiona Apple. She kind of burst onto the public consciousness nearly 20 years ago when she was still a teenager. She's 42 now. She hasn't put out any music really since 2012. So, you know, you were kind of hoping for a decent album from Fiona Apple, but what we got was just an excellent, incredible album that's sort of perfect for these times. It sounds mostly home recorded. You hear her singing and playing at on the piano at the forefront, but there's also just lots of banging on the records. And it's not like drums or anything. She's just like banging on makeshift percussion, including apparently like a box containing her dead dog's bones. So yeah, it just, you know, it doesn't feel like it was made in a studio. It feels like it was made in somebody's living room. And I feel like that kind of feeling is very relatable.
Hmm. By the way, this DJ session is being made in my living room and your living room right now as we speak. So let's get to the next one. This is from the Montreal group Pilada. This is called Habla Tu Verdad.
Defiendo tu opresión de mi edad. Yo no defiendo tu opresión.
So we said this group Pelada is from Montreal, but as you can hear there, it's being sung in Spanish.
Yeah, it's one of the many interesting dichotomies with Pelada. You got Chris Vargas, who's singing in Spanish over these like smooth, kind of borderline cheesy rave beats from the 90s that producer Toby Rockman does. And, you know, it's also just sort of, in a weird way, Pelada reminds me of Rage Against the Machine, who took kind of two familiar genres, rock and rap, and sort of fused them into one. I kind of feel like Chris Vargas definitely has sort of like a Zach De La Rocha thing performing live. And I got to check them out a couple months ago, back when people were going out, and they absolutely blew me away.
Back when people were going out. Oh, it's so sad. It was so short of a time ago, and yet it feels like forever ago. The next one that you brought us is in French. This is Fou by L'Impératrice. Ça démarre au quart de tour, la pensée fait des tours, et plus la montre tourne, plus tu perds le nord. On te dit de rester sourd, de taper des tombeaux, le fond de l'air est lourd, et tu dérives encore. Mon tir a permis, faiblir interdit, soit cool, soit poli. Dans l'ordre établi, tu cherches la sortie. Bye bye les gentils, toi tu cries plus fort.
Tell us about this one, Travis.
L'Impératrice, they put out an album last year called Mata Hari that was low-key, one of my favorite records of 2019. And, you know, we just talked about in an alternate universe, we used to go out. In an alternate universe, Coachella just wrapped up a couple weekends ago, and L'Impératrice sort of blew everyone away. But hopefully that still happens in October. But the track we just listened to is called Fou. It's their brand-new single, and continues in the great tradition of French groups doing disco really well, a lineage that kind of starts back in the late 70s with the Rockets and Black Devil Disco Club and continues on through Daft Punk, Justice, and Breakbot.
Okay, the next one that you have brought us is a new Frank Ocean song. This is called Dear April, and it's the Justice remix. And we got up again, and what we had can't be the same. You made me new. It's like you took me through. It's like you woke me up. You made me new. You took me through. You woke me up. You woke me up. You know, Travis, I'm so glad that you picked this song, because one of my quarantine TV shows that I was able to catch up on completely was Insecure on HBO, which uses references to Frank Ocean all the time. But what do you take away from this particular song?
Well, I mean, Frank Ocean is the biggest artist of his generation. I don't know if a lot of people realize that. But I mean, last year we had the Camp Flognow Carnival here in Los Angeles. This was in the fall time. And they had a secret headliner, and everyone was speculating. And, like, finally the consensus was it's going to be Frank Ocean. It's definitely going to be Frank Ocean. He was dropping a bunch of tracks right around that time. And Drake showed up, and people were so disappointed to see Drake and not Frank Ocean.
All right, well, last but not least, we have Rose in the Dark. This is by Cleo Soul. I'm a little wiser, baby. Beautiful voice there, Travis. Tell us more about Cleo Soul.
Cleo Soul is a soul singer from the UK, and her debut album just came out. It's also called Rose in the Dark, on this label called Forever Living Originals, which is the label that brought us a group called Salt that kind of came out of nowhere last year and released two excellent albums. That track that we heard is produced by an artist named Inflow, who's also had a hand previously in projects from Michael Kiwanuka and Portugal the Man. But that track in particular, Rose in the Dark, is one that I've been playing a lot on my show. It's just got like a very timeless feel to it.
Well, Travis, I am so glad that you brought us this music today to give us a little bit of a break from the news, and also that you still believe that there will be a Coachella in October, because if that happens, that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's probably a bit too optimistic, but you got to have hope
we'll
in something.
You got to have hope. Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Jeremy. Stay safe out there.
You too. And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Some of the countries, like South Korea, with the most success flattening their coronavirus curves, used contact tracing, tracking back from a patient who's tested positive, to find the people they might have come in contact with so they can be treated or quarantined. This helped contain AIDS and Ebola. And the job here is enormous. Cell phones and credit cards are being used to show where a person might have been. Apps are being developed that use Bluetooth or GPS data. But the telephone is still important, and Oscar Baez is one of those using it. He was serving as a foreign service officer in Jerusalem when the State Department pulled him home to Boston. He's now working as part of a contact tracing team with Partners in Health. Oscar, who are you calling?
Hi, Robin. So we're basically trying to call any new case that's been diagnosed with COVID-19 in the state. And we are the ones who inform them that they need to safely isolate. And then we try to gather anyone they may have exposed to the virus in the last 48 hours, even before they were symptomatic. The idea is basically, I believe it's described oftentimes as social distancing measures, stay-at-home orders are our first line of defense against the virus. This is the other tack of playing offense. And we actually follow up. We do a home assessment and get a sense of, can you safely quarantine? Can you safely get through these 2 weeks? Because oftentimes we see the headlines of the virus being deadly itself, but for the most at risk and vulnerable in our communities, quarantine itself can be a life or death matter if you are unable to access food the next day, if you have a baby that needs a formula and you've been unemployed. And so I think it's really critical us to maintain that the human connection.
Boy, Oscar, it is, I said detective, it's detective, it's social work, it's a health officer in a way. There's a lot going on here. So a couple things. First of all, you're talking to people who may not even, they may have tested positive and they're not sick because we know you do that with COVID-19. You can be asymptomatic, so it might be shocking to some people. But now you're going to go back over who they may have come in contact with. So then you have to call those people. How do they respond?
There are a couple of challenges we come across. So there's already a huge sense of anxiety throughout our society based on what's happening. But there's also been news of, scams and some people taking advantage of what's happening. So we have had to actually make sure to work with providers to have a caller ID that identifies as Massachusetts COVID team. And we have to build a trust.
Well, I'm wondering are they also sometimes embarrassed? I knew I had a cough and I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you I went to work, when in fact it's critical that they tell you that they went to work so you can contact those people.
Yes, oftentimes, because there is that sense of embarrassment, sense of guilt, and oftentimes we have to reiterate that actually we have to maintain confidentiality. So when we then reach out, we have to protect that information. But at the same time, when we inform those who have potentially been exposed, then they're the ones who sometimes want more information on who specifically was it that exposed this to me, and we can't share that. So there's some frustration there, but again, I think in the end, everyone understands that we need to cooperate and adhere to the guidelines.
I know you have some sensitive cases. Is there one you can tell us about?
Well, I grew up in an immigrant community in the city of Boston, in several neighborhoods, and there are certain trends to the kind of the profile of the people that we have to reach out to, and so specific cases that to me have laid bare the inequalities that existed before COVID, we've expected these essential workers to continue to work as caregivers. So the cases that I've seen are nurses or caregivers working in assisted living communities in nursing homes, where one said, everyone on my floor got sick. She was discharged from the hospital and then still had symptoms and needed a nebulizer. Didn't have prescription, was too sick to really even describe these things. So I had to navigate through the process with her daughter, who was isolated in the same home, but also with COVID. And it's just kind of everything snowballs together. And I think it's just they really appreciate having someone on the outside take a step back, walk them through it, and just facilitate. I mean, Boston steps up. Boston Strong to me is not just a slogan. But I think because of the digital divide, because of the existing inequalities in our systems, in our communities, there needs to be somebody to accompany these patients.
Boy, I tell you, Oscar Baez, should I ever have to get this call, I want it to come from you. Thank you so much for talking to us. Oscar, a Foreign Service officer, now working as a contact tracer in Boston, where he grew up, telling people when they test positive for COVID-19, but also then trying to track back to others they may have infected and helping them along the way, as we heard. Oscar, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.